Carrie gave a formal, even brusque, greeting, and the edge in her voice told Raquella that something had upset her as well. The old sorceress regarded her with sharp green eyes, then said without preamble, "You can sense it yourself, can't you?" Raquella nodded stiffly. "The tension in the air is pervasive. I was collecting samples in the jungle, pondering important sisterhood issues, when suddenly my thoughts took over my body. I stopped where I was, frozen on the trail. I had slipped into mentat mode. I let my mind follow a cascade of consequences, just as I learned in the mentat school on Lampadas, but could make no projection. I was so disturbed that I rushed to meet the other sister mentats to chart our future, as we often do, and we all felt an urgency in the air." The Reverend Mother nodded, a sensation of impending trouble. "It has been this way ever since we returned from Seleucus Secundus." In her mind, Raquella could not trace the source. "You brought something back with you," Carrie said. "Something that poses a possible threat to us." "Anna Carino?" Raquella let out a long, slow breath. Now that she paid closer attention, the uneasiness was like a grating sound just below the edge of audibility. "It's a great honor to have the Emperor's sister here, but it exposes us to terrible risk if anything should happen to her. As a sorceress, my psychic abilities make me more sensitive than other people. However, this dangerous tension affects the other five sister mentats too, and none of them are sorceresses. It affects you as well." Carrie gazed out at the smoke-tinged sunset, which was splashing colors over the polymerized treetops. "For some time now, we sister mentats have been gathering data, running projections. We believe that the sisterhood is going to face a terrible schism that will set sister against sister." "A schism over what?" "The same fracture that runs through all of human society. A dispute over the use of technology. I fear that some sisters may suspect the nature of our breeding database. There are rumors of computers in the sisterhood." Raquella swallowed hard. The voices in her head were very concerned, whispering contradictory advice, but after so many years she had learned to control them, to push them into the background when she needed to concentrate. "My concern is with improving the breeding stock of humanity, filtering out undesirable traits, making our race strong. The urge to harm other human beings, for example, could be eliminated, resulting in more harmonious societies. Social engineering at its optimum. I straddle the fence, my old friend. As a sorceress and mentat, who knows about the breeding record computers? You speak of molding human traits, but who is to determine what is desirable and what is not? That smacks of what machines do. To meddle with human breeding is dangerous." Raquella, though, had too much invested in her far-reaching vision, and her other memories had insisted on it. "Not if we do it right. And you are correct. A mentat cannot make accurate projections with incomplete data. We will have to bring the other sister mentats into the secret." "Be careful," Carrie said. "If even one of them has Butlerian sympathies." "Yes, we must be careful. But if we cannot trust the highest-ranking members of our sisterhood, what is the future of our project?" Carrie pursed her wrinkled lips. "The situation is complicated. There are many possible futures, many of which could result in disaster. The breeding program is the core of the sisterhood, a noble cause that gives us purpose. We must not abandon it." The tension in the dusk had grown even sharper, gnawing at the back of Raquella's mind. Her gnarled hands tensed on the rail, and she silently vowed not to lose what she had worked so hard to create. Deep inside the cliffside maze of tunnels and caverns, two sisters shared a private meal of bread, wine, cheese and jungle fruits. Sister Dorothea had not seen her green-robed young friend Ingrid in more than a year, and they were anxious to catch up on their friendship. Since arriving back on Rossac, Dorothea had already returned to her work with Sister Carrie down in the jungle research chambers, while Valya introduced Anna Carino to the daily routine of an acolyte. Over their first glasses of rich red wine, Dorothea told young Ingrid all about the imperial court on Seleucia Secundus and how she had advised Roderick and Salvador Carino. Despite the glamour and excitement of the capital world, she was pleased to be home, away from the pettiness of imperial politics and intrigue. Preoccupied, Sister Ingrid sat listening, not saying much in response. She swallowed a slice of cheese without the bread and washed it down with wine, both of which were imported from Lampedus. The news here is not good. Though I don't believe the sisters recognize it themselves, factions are beginning to develop. It started out as an intellectual conversation at a midday meal, but escalated to real disagreements over the use of forbidden technology. Many of the sisters are like us. They loathe anything that reminds them of the thinking machines. Others assert that we should preserve some aspects of computer technology to make our lives easier. I'm disappointed to hear that. Dorothea's face tightened. The debate is vehement back in Zimia, but here I would have expected our sisters to reach the obvious and correct conclusion that such technology is dangerous and unnecessary. Dorothea stared at her newly empty wine glass. Human beings can do whatever machines can. I have argued about the dangers of technology, but some sisters will not listen. Sister Hieta, for example, and Sister Parga both use an ancient saying that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. They argue that we should retain some thinking machines to aid humankind, to give people more leisure time for important pursuits. It's nonsense, of course. In the few days I've been back, I've heard nothing of this issue. Dorothea set the glass aside. How widespread are these arguments? Hieta and Parga have perhaps 25 women with them, not a large group, and around the same number support our view. Most sisters prefer to stay out of the fray, but no one can avoid this issue forever. Some people have short memories, and bad thinking leads to bad decisions, Dorothea said. But the sisterhood does not use thinking machines, so it's an irrelevant argument. Ingrid pinched her face into a scowl. She looked around, lowered her voice. There are rumors of computers here on Rossac. Dorothea nearly choked on the berries she had popped into her mouth. What? The breeding information maintained by the sisterhood is vast. No human mind, or combination of human minds, even our mentats, can encompass it all. Some sisters have concluded that computers are being used. If that is true, we have a problem, a very serious one. Back on Lampedus, I heard reports of Butlerian search and destroy missions, Ingrid said. It would be a shame if that were to happen here. Dorothea no longer had an appetite. We must see that it doesn't, then. If there are computers on Rossac, we must find them and destroy them ourselves. Love endures, but flesh does not. One must grasp any possible happiness in the time allotted to him in this life. Vorian Atreides, Private Journals. Accompanied by 9 surplus military ships provided by Emperor Salvador Carino, Vorian returned to Kepler, feeling triumphant but burdened. Mariella would hate the terms that bound him, but he'd been forced to agree. Besides, after all these years in one place, maybe it was time for Vor to move on. Given the enthusiastic and hopeful cheers he had received from the crowds on Seleucia Secundus, he knew the Emperor had good reason to be worried. Vor had used his own leverage as much as possible, reaching one definition of a reasonable agreement in that both sides were somewhat dissatisfied with the terms, but willing to accept it nonetheless. At least Kepler would be safe. Vor's loved ones would be safe. These leftover warships from the Army of Humanity would stand guard in orbit, stationed there indefinitely to frighten away slavers. Within 12 months, the Imperial troops manning the vessels would be recalled to Seleucus Secundus, but the ships would remain behind. By then, Vor's people would be trained to mount their own defenses. They would not be caught unawares again, and no longer would human predators see this backwater world as easy pickings. But he wished he didn't have to leave Kepler, and hoped that Mariella would go with him, though he did not hold out much hope in that regard. She was old, and her children and grandchildren were here. A lifetime of memories were here, and at her stage in life, it would not be easy for her to leave it all behind. After Vor landed his ship on an open, stubbled field in the middle of the valley, his people rushed forward, cheering. They had made welcoming banners and signs for him, and his chest swelled as the applause buffeted him. The locals seemed to consider the liberation of the captives as equivalent to a victory against the thinking machines. He viewed the smiling faces of people he had last seen in the Porotrin slave markets when he paid for their passage back home. His daughter Bonda stood here, holding the small dog he had purchased as part of his disguise in New Starda. He saw work crews, construction machinery, lumber deliveries. The homes and outbuildings damaged in the slave raid were already being rebuilt or repaired as the villagers worked together to strengthen their community. And they all cheered him. It meant more to him than all the pageants and parades in Zimia. Tears sprang to his eyes. Vor loved this world and these people, and he hated the fact that he would have to depart. But he had agreed to the terms in order to keep Kepler safe. A fair trade. Neither Salvador nor Roderick had hinted that they might address the greater problem of rampant slaving operations, but for now Vor's focus was closer to home. The home he would soon have to leave behind. At the front of the crowd, he spotted the face he most longed to see. Weathered and lined with age, her hair gray but eyes bright, stood Mariella. And when Vor looked through his heart instead of his eyes, he still saw the beautiful woman he had romanced so many decades before. Over the centuries, Vorian Atreides had been blessed with a succession of deep and abiding loves. In his youth, he had loved the legendary Serena Butler, although chastely. And next there was Laronica Tergier from Caladan. His two sons by Laronica had both gone off to form their own families far away, leaving Caladan. Then Mariella had been the center of his life for more than 50 years. He remembered them all, still loved them all, and could envision their faces in brief glimpses of memory. But time and a plethora of human lives flowed past him like the waters of a rushing stream, while he remained stuck, a rock in the midst of the cascade. Sometimes, beloved people like Laronica or Mariella splashed up a high spray around him, but eventually they too passed on. And he could see just how old Mariella was. In his younger years, Vorian had lived an oblivious, sheltered life, running ominous updates across the synchronized worlds with his closest friend, the independent robot Surratt. Reading Agamemnon's memoirs had led him to believe he understood the feral humans and their squalid lives. He had wanted to please his father. The other 12 known sons of Agamemnon had been raised, trained, and ultimately killed by the Symec general. From an early age, Vor had dreamed of being a Symec one day, of having his brain removed from his weak biological body so he could live indefinitely as a Symec beside titans like Agamemnon, Juno, Xerxes, and Ajax. But that had never happened. Instead, after Vor had won a huge victory against humans, General Agamemnon dragged him off to a Symec laboratory, strapped Vor to a table, and tortured him with probes, burning chemicals, and sharp instruments. Thus, through unspeakable pain, Agamemnon bestowed the life extension treatment that made his 13th and best son virtually immortal. "I gave you many centuries," he had told Vor later. You can't expect that to come cheap. Afterward, Vor had agreed that enduring the pain was indeed a small price to pay for a vastly extended life, albeit in his original human body. In the long and difficult centuries that followed, however, Vor had his doubts. On Kepler, again he remained unchanged, while everyone grew old around him. Now, ignoring the rest of the crowd, he wrapped his arms around Mariella and drew her close. He wanted to embrace her tightly and never let go. She melted up against him.
I'm so glad you're home. Thank you for what you did.
The crush of people around Vor demanded his attention, and though he was not interested in feasts or celebrations, nevertheless his family and neighbors insisted on it. Bonda and Tyr came up, laughing, and lifted their little dog so that it could lick his cheek. Smiling, Vor raised his hands for silence and shouted, All of you will be safe now. I've reached an agreement with Emperor Carino. The whole Imperium knows that he has issued a decree making this planet off-limits to slavers. A group of armed ships will be stationed in orbit overhead, and I have arranged to provide you with additional weapons for defending your families and homes. No one will ever prey upon this world again. From their cheers and whistles, they obviously expected little else from the great Vorian Atreides. They would feel obligated to shower him with well-intentioned gifts, helping on his farm, cooking food, making clothing for him, whether or not he needed it. He had never seen the people so happy. It pained his heart that he would have to leave without telling them, except for Mariella. When the two of them returned home late that night, weary from dancing and conversation and feasting, their ears ringing from music, Vor noted that the roof had been repaired from the fire the slavers had set. The house also had a fresh coat of paint and new shingles. Mariella looked tired when she entered the drawing room and sat in a chair, pulling a blanket onto her lap. Our home has been so lonely, Vor. Just having you back fills it up. He heated water to make tea and sat next to her, studying her face, eager to preserve every remaining moment with her. Our family doesn't need to worry anymore. I made sure of that. He hesitated as he sipped his strong herbal tea with a faint hint of mélange. His wife held her cup, just staring at the steam that rose from the liquid. Her eyes sparkled as if with a sheen of tears. Did she suspect already? His voice cracked as he said, But I had to make certain concessions. I had to agree that I would drop out of sight again.
I was afraid of that, Mariella said with a long sigh. I know you well, my husband, and I've been sensing a darkness today, something you were having trouble telling me.
Vor swallowed hard. He loved this life on Kepler, wanted to remain here forever, but that was impossible. I'm an antique, a relic of the past. With the jihad over, the Imperium needs to move on, but I'm a reminder of the past. The Emperor is uneasy to have someone with such great popularity in the Lansrod League. No matter how much I insist that I have no interest in taking the throne, he will always harbor that doubt. And there would be people coming out of the proverbial woodwork wanting to use me to accomplish their own agendas. He shook his head and said in a low voice, Before Salvador Carino would agree to protect Kepler, he made this his strict condition.
I have to go away. Vorian Atreides must seem to disappear. Permanently.
She gave him a wan smile, but the tears stayed in her eyes, and in the flood of emotions she seemed to be having trouble coming up with what to say. He straightened.
I want you to come with me, Mariella. We can move to another world. We'll review dozens of candidates first, if you like. We can bring our children, too. Anyone who wants to go.
His words came out in a rush as he began to feel hope again.
It would be a grand adventure for all of us.
Oh, Vor.
As much as I love you, I can't leave, Kepler. This is my home. And you can't uproot our children, our grandchildren, their families, their friends, their spouses, everyone in this whole valley. Four's throat went dry. I don't want to leave without you. We could go together, just the two of us. Don't be foolish. I am an old woman, too old to start a new life. We both know you will have to move on without me, sooner or later. She wiped her cheeks self-consciously, then patted her gray hair. It's time you left anyway, so you don't have to see me grow any older. It's embarrassing to have such a handsome young man in my bed. I hadn't noticed that you were any less beautiful, Four said, barely able to form the words. And I mean that. I'm the one who should be thankful, not you. He wrestled with his emotions and obligations. He could change his appearance and his name, remain hidden on Kepler in some remote outpost. What difference would it make? A handful of the people would know, but he could swear them to secrecy, and Emperor Salvador would never find out. Four sighed in resignation. Such things were always discovered, and if he went back on his word, it could put his family and neighbors in danger. Mariella said in a musing voice, "You've already given me a happier life and a longer marriage than any woman could hope for. But I know you were born to wander. When we first married, you explained the fact that you don't age. We both knew, and we both agreed, that a time would come when you would have to move on. But not during your lifetime." "Maybe it is better this way," she insisted. He went to her chair, bent down, and kissed her on the cheek, then on the lips, a kiss that reminded him of their first so long ago. "Leaving you reminds me of just how long I've been alive, Mariella. Nobody understands how heavily the years can weigh upon a person." "Do you know where you'll go? Or does that have to be a secret?" "I only promised the Emperor I would leave Kepler and never come back. Not that I wouldn't tell you. I have in mind a place I'd like to visit," he said. "Arrakis. I need a clean break, and I've heard there are tribes in the deserts there, people with incredibly long lifespans, possibly from constant consumption of melange. I doubt they've lived as long as I have, but they might have some insights for me." "I'll think of you every day," Mariella said. "I'll tell our children so that they know you're out there somewhere, and safe. And you'll know where we are. We won't forget you." "And I could never forget you," he said. "My love for you is in every breath I take. When I get established, I'll send word. I'll find a way to stay in touch. I am the real emperor of the known universe, and Salvador Carino is my puppet." Manfred Torondo, Remarks to Inari, Idaho. Roderick Carino experienced feelings of unease whenever he watched combat robots in the private exhibition fights sponsored by his brother. Behind safety barriers, elegantly dressed noblemen and their ladies watched, cheering for their favorites and booing opponents. It was evening in a small private arena on the grounds of the Imperial Palace, following a sumptuous feast. Many of the nobles wore veils and domino masks to disguise their identities and protect them. The Butlerian influence on Seleucia remained strong. According to the tight legal strictures set out at the end of the jihad, these reactivated robots had no artificial intelligence whatsoever and were instead programmed to run through a series of fighting maneuvers, which were salted with chance variables, flaws that would cause an unexpected deficiency or surprise enhancements.
Spectators did not know in advance which type of fighter they were getting when they placed their wagers, and the outcome was never predetermined. Roderick had to admit that it made for interesting, stimulating entertainment, watching these vanquished machine demons duel in the arena, knowing that they would destroy one another. Because it danced so close to the cliff edge of forbidden technology, the carefully selected nobles were titillated by the spectacle. Such events were, of course, kept secret from Butlerian observers. When his brother first suggested the idea, Roderick had cringed. If Manfred Torondo ever found out what the Emperor and his inner circle of nobles did behind the high gates and walls of the private estate. But Salvador brushed aside his concerns. Nobles must have their diversions. It's harmless entertainment, and the end result is to destroy robots, so what is the harm? Roderick could imagine a great deal of harm, so without his brother's knowledge, he had doubled security surrounding each private combat exhibition, and made certain that only the most trusted nobles were invited, each of whom was sworn to secrecy, a pledge that the powerful Carino family could enforce. Now he watched as two combat robots, one with a deep copper alloy skin and the other shimmering chrome, circled one another, probing with built-in, though limited, weapons that battered each other, knocking their armored bodies to the ground. A small army of palace guards surrounded the ring, bearing heavy weapons and ready to destroy any combat mech that might get out of hand. Sitting in his private shaded box beside Roderick, the Emperor spoke with Alfonso Nitta, a wheedling nobleman in search of a favor to curtail the operations of a business adversary. Nitta manufactured expensive ladies' dresses, and an upstart commoner had opened a large rival business on Hegel after paying bribes to the planetary leader. "It's dirty business," Nitta insisted. "The Hegels have a grudge against House Nitta because my grandfather reported their grandfather's illegal war, profiteering operations during the jihad." Salvador kept his eyes on the clashing robots. "I'll see what I can do." He didn't seem interested, and Nitta was particularly inept in making his request. Roderick helped the nobleman with a nudge because he didn't seem to understand how business was conducted at this level. "Investigating the matter will take time and resources, Lord Nitta. The Emperor has to worry about his discretionary budget." Finally, Nitta's eyes lit up with understanding.
"Ah, perhaps as a demonstration of the quality of my product, I'll provide a large sampling of my finest dresses for the Empress Tabrina. Lovely gowns, the most lavish wardrobe to make her breathtakingly beautiful for you, sire. Perhaps even some stylish unmentionables could be arranged."
Roderick sighed. Considering the state of his brother's relationship with Tabrina, it was precisely the wrong thing to say. Salvador responded coolly. "I said I'll look into the matter." The nobleman bowed and turned his attention back to the combat event. After a while, the Emperor leaned closer to Roderick, smiling as one of the combat mechs tore a cylindrical arm from its opponent.
"This is so appropriate. First we lobotomize the robots, and now we make them destroy each other. I could watch this all day."
Roderick smiled. "It's preferable to having the machines compel humans to do what they command." In the stands, a rotund new invitee squealed, afraid of the ferocious metallic monsters, then laughed when he realized there was no actual danger.
"I can't remember," Salvador said. "What did we wager today?"
Roderick knew his brother remembered precisely what they had bet against each other. "Our summer villas on Catane, of course. Whoever wins gets both."
"Oh, yes. I've always preferred yours."
The copper-skinned robot launched a spiked spear from under its forearm, knocking the other machine down where it lay on the ground, twitching and sparking. The first mech moved in for the kill. "It looks as if my robot is winning," Roderick said. "But you know you're always welcome to use my villa, if you like." His elder brother's forehead wrinkled like a folded piece of paper.
"What's that? The copper mech is mine. Do you really believe that damaged hulk can fight back?"
"You chose the chrome one, dear brother. Remember, you picked first. Salvador's blue eyes flashed. He liked to act absent-minded when it suited him, but Roderick knew his mind was sharp. The Carino Emperor was far more intelligent than most people realized. Crafty, smart. He knew full well that he had chosen the Chrome Mech.
Very well. But you should feel guilty the way you always get the better of me.
It was pure luck this time. We had no way of knowing which robot would win. The Emperor ran a finger along his lips.
I suppose we could cheat.
Against each other. I wouldn't do that to you.
As I am so often reminded, you are a better man than I.
Roderick disagreed, as he was expected to, but both men knew it was true. The Chrome robot did rally and lurched to its feet to continue the fight, accompanied by a round of delighted cheers. Another disguised nobleman came and whispered a request into Salvador's ear. The thin domino mask did not hide the identity of elderly Tibar Werrick, a prominent real estate broker who needed a favor. Throughout these gladiatorial combats, inner circle invitees would make such requests, and Roderick would have to implement most of them, according to his brother's decisions. When the copper-skinned mech finally defeated its opponent, battering it into twitching shrapnel, the palace guard stepped forward and blasted the winner down. Tibar Werrick complained about deferred or defaulted payments from the new Souk Medical School, an extravagant complex under construction on Parmentier. Roderick thought the elite doctors had pretensions of grandeur. However, because Salvador had received a great many expensive and questionable, in Roderick's opinion, medical treatments from the former head of the Souk School, he often turned a blind eye toward the excesses. Werrick was quite upset by the losses, and the Emperor dismissed him with a promise. When the nobleman was gone, and as staff members dragged the robot debris off the fighting field, Salvador turned to Roderick. Werrick says there's a scandal brewing involving a Souk doctor who duped a patient. You heard that Lars Ibsen of Caladan died recently? Roderick remembered the wealthy commoner who had built a fishing empire and lived like an emperor himself. According to Werrick, Ibsen relied on a Souk doctor and paid a king's ransom for bone cancer treatments, treatments that turned out to be bogus, complete placebos. Ibsen didn't live any longer, and certainly died poorer. Roderick didn't comment that he thought many of Ilobando's prescribed treatments for the Emperor fell into the same category. After Bando's highly suspicious suicide on Parmentier, investigations had been closed, but Roderick suspected a more widespread problem among the Souks. Do you think the medical school would agree to a detailed audit of their operations? We've heard of investors loaning money to the school, and we know the Souks take in substantial revenues for their services, but it still doesn't seem to add up. Much of the funding for their extravagant expansion had come from the exorbitant sums Salvador himself had paid to the former head of the school. A scandal could hamstring their good work, Salvador said. The Butlerians object to advanced medical treatment, and I wouldn't want to give them the wedge. He rubbed his temples.
Besides, I need another personal physician, and the Souks haven't sent me an acceptable one yet. I miss poor Dr. Bando. The school isn't the same without him.
Despite the corrupt medical practices of some doctors, Roderick knew the Souk school still produced better physicians than any other school in the Imperium, and he remembered the remarkable good that Mohanda Souk had done during the machine plagues. Unlike Salvador, though, he believed the loss of Ilobando improved their respectability rather than worsened it. Let me look into it, sire. If they're evading Seleucid taxes or defaulting on payments, they will be held to account.
The school is becoming problematic, too full of its own importance.
Salvador was troubled.
I don't want them shut down. At least not yet. Not before I get my own personal physician.
At the very least, they should have closer monitoring. The Emperor nodded, then leaned forward as the next combat mechs shambled into the fighting area.
You're right, as usual, little brother. Let's deepen our normal financial investigations of them and see what we turn up.
Do we derive our identity, our worth, from our families, or from ourselves? Reverend Mother Raquel Berto Anarul, Sisterhood Training Manual. As Princess Anna's mentor and protector, Valya tried to discover how to motivate the young woman and make her a stronger person. But the girl had very little drive. Raised and sheltered in the Imperial Palace, Anna was prone to impulsive, somewhat juvenile decisions and mood swings. Sisterhood training should eventually teach her how to deal with that, and Anna would return to Seleucia Secundus as a changed woman, and Valya's close friend. Perhaps Anna would ask Valya to accompany her back to Zimia and give her a position at court. From there, Valya could open political doors for her brother. His success in the Landsraad League would go a long way toward restoring Harkonnen wealth. But that was not all she wanted, not by a long shot. She actually considered the assassination of Vorian Atreides to be an even higher priority than getting Griffin to Zimia, which was why she had demanded that he go in search of the treacherous man who had brought down House Harkonnen. If Griffin cauterized the festering wound that had made generations of Harkonnen so miserable, their family could finally escape the ignominy they had been forced to endure for 80 years. The terrible pall of shame that had been covering them like a Lankavale ice sheet. Revenge was more important to her than wealth. Far more important. Back on her cold and barren homeworld, Valya had seen little point in marrying a native fisherman or whale hunter. Her great-grandfather Abelard had left the family with no legacy, and her own father had few ambitions, too readily accepting their drastically reduced state. Her mother Sonia was a traditional local woman who had never been off-planet and was not interested in the rest of the Imperium. Since she had no noble blood, she was willing to accept the pittance of a life she and her family had, not questioning what House Harkonnen's enemies had done to them. Valya could not be so passive. Once she escaped from Lankavale and the millstone it represented, she intended to accomplish a great deal for House Harkonnen. For a young woman in her situation, the Rossack School seemed to offer limitless possibilities, as proven by this chance to establish close ties with the Carinos. Even so, Valya was quickly losing excitement about her assignment to befriend Anna Carino. The girl was sweet, with many misconceptions about how others lived, and sometimes the job tested Valya's patience. Alone now, she hurried down one corridor and then another, calling Anna's name, but getting no response. The girl was so unpredictable. A few minutes ago, as breakfast ended in the great dining chamber and sisters were milling about or heading for the exits, the green-robed Anna had slipped away, melting into the crowd of women. Did she think this was a game? Muttering, Valya felt a sinking sensation. If anything bad happened to the Carino princess, it would not be good for the sisterhood, nor for Valya's personal ambitions. As she passed an alcove, she saw Anna peeking out from around a statue of one of the heroes of the jihad, chortling like a preteen. Valya was the same age as Anna, but there was a huge gulf of maturity between them. "Don't ever do that again." Valya took her by the hand and pulled her out with a little more force than she intended. "I can take care of myself," Anna said. Valya controlled her temper, reminding herself of this young woman's connections. "Rossack has dangers, and the sisterhood has rules. I'm just trying to watch out for you." She kept protectively close to Anna as she guided her to an Imperial economics class. When she released Anna just inside the classroom, the princess frowned. "You won't sit next to me?" Natural light illuminated the room, entering through slits and crevices in the rock, accompanied by a warm breeze that was redolent with the pungent odors of the jungle. "This is a class for acolytes, and I have another assignment," Valya said. "I'll come and get you after the lecture."
"Are you my best friend now?" Anna asked. "I haven't had a good friend for a long time."
Valya softened her voice. "Yes. I'm your best friend now. Trust me, once you adjust here, you won't want to go home."
She put a gentle hand on the girl's shoulder.
Hirondo really cared for me.
Anna looked dejected and needy.
My stepmother Arena loved me.
And now you have me, and we have trust. Anna looked up at her.
My brothers never trusted me.
Then you're better off here, with us. Through her own feelings and goals, Valya felt some sympathy for this misfit young woman who had suffered from her doomed infatuation with a lowly kitchen worker. But Valya knew emotional attachments might compromise her own mission in life. She saw plainly that Anna was in desperate need of a friend, and no doubt had been for years. Valya intended to fill that role, partly out of pity, but primarily for her own reasons. She could only hope Griffin would also fulfill his obligations. He should already be on his way to deal with Vorian Atreides. Logic and reason are deceptive. They can lead a person to lose his soul. Manfred Tarondo, speech on Seleucia Secundus. Though the Butlerian movement had spread across the Imperium, their headquarters on Lampadus were modest and unpretentious. Manfred felt that the domination of thinking machines should have taught mankind humility at the very least. It was through hubris and ambition that the original Titans had created the computer Evermind in the first place. Propped up in a chair at his desk, which hid his lack of legs from visitors, he pored over lists of planets where his representatives had conducted successful demonstration raids. Occasionally, the local Butlerian leaders dispatched holo recordings, but Manfred preferred the more intimate experience of reading words written by a human hand. Mankind had gotten into a great deal of trouble by looking for shortcuts, speed, and simplification. Devices could be so seductive. He remained haunted by the dark words Erasmus the robot had written in his journal. Given enough time, they will forget, and they will create us all over again. When vehicles were easily available, lethargic people grew fat because they were too lazy to walk. Calculating machines could provide swift answers to complex sums, but what happened when the human mind atrophied and forgot how to calculate? As proof of human potential and superiority, mentats from the school of Gilbertus Albans performed all the functions a computer could, and they were far more trustworthy than any calculating machine. Though Manfred longed for a quiet season with Inari, where they could watch the natural pace of the harvest and the changing weather on Lampadus, he knew he had not been made for a normal life, nor had his beloved mentor Raina Butler. She'd survived the horrific Omnius plagues, while her whole family died around her. Forever scarred by the experience, Raina spent her entire life insisting that humanity expunge its dependence on machines. Following her heroic example, Manfred had been through a similar crucible. He was just as scarred, but in a different way, and he was just as driven. He would be traveling again soon. There were always planets that needed to hear his words. Inari Idaho entered the office wearing her impeccable black and gray uniform. Her hair was cut short, her face scrubbed clean to show her rough beauty. The devotion on her expression was as indelible as a tattoo. Two off-worlders are here to request a meeting. The slight downturn of her mouth was a sign of disapproval. They have brought equipment. Manfred set the documents aside. Who are they? What kind of equipment? They come from the planet Zenith, scientists of some sort. One of them acts as if he is a person of note. Now, Manfred was curious. After asking the man's name and making no connection with it, he said, "What do scientists want here?" "Shall I interrogate them?" She sounded eager. Manfred knew that if he requested it, she would break their necks without batting an eyelash. He didn't know what he'd ever do without her. "Send them in. I'll talk with these scientists myself. If I need you to do anything, I will ask." A pair of diminutive men entered the room, pulling a sealed case the size of a small coffin. It floated on suspensors, and the blinking lights of a diagnostic panel shone on the top. The smaller of the two belonged to the disgraced Tluloxa race. He had short, dark hair and a pinched expression, and he was obviously subordinate. After the horrific scandal that had brought down the Tluloxa organ farms during Serena Butler's jihad, most humans carried an intrinsic animus toward the race. But the Tluloxa had been subdued, supposedly rehabilitated. In recent decades, zealous Butlerians had established a watchdog presence on the main Tluloxa worlds, closely monitoring any research being conducted there. Many of their insidious projects had been quashed, much to the consternation of the Tluloxa masters. But they had been meek and cooperative. He expected no trouble from them. The second man, obviously the one in charge, was not a Tluloxa. Large eyes gave him an owlish look. He had brown hair, a weak chin, and a studious demeanor that made him seem more like an accountant than a researcher. The bookish man came briskly forward, evincing a scholarly and even conciliatory manner. "Thank you for seeing us on such short notice, Leader Tarondo. I am Ptolemy, an independent scientist and Lensrod representative from Zenith. This is my good friend and research associate, Dr. Elchan." Manford kept his expression cool. "And what brings you to Lampetus? Very few self-proclaimed scientists offer to join our movement for the preservation of the human soul." He forced a smile. "But I remain optimistic." Ptolemy blinked his owlish eyes, took a moment to gather his bearings. "That is part of the reason we've come. You may have heard of my planet, Zenith, which encourages and funds many research projects designed for the benefit of the human race. Medical advances, agricultural developments, automated shelter construction for the poor on primitive worlds. As the official representative from Zenith, I heard the speech you presented at the Lansrod Hall, and I felt compelled to see you in person." "Ah, now I remember you. You spoke on the record." At the time, the man had seemed weak and unimpressive, as if the fate of the human race could be boiled down to a simple schoolhouse debate. Ptolemy offered a smile. "Though I admit I did not agree with your argument, I respect your convictions and passion. A man must speak up when he has strong convictions. That is what makes humans great." "We can agree on that. A bit of common ground." "Only a starting point." Manford wondered what these men intended. "I have to believe we can talk like reasonable men. Your impassioned speech gave me much food for thought." "Good." Manford folded his hands together on the desk. "Humans think. Machines don't. The mind of man is holy." "The mind of man is holy," Anari murmured. "Our two sides have grown so far apart they no longer hear each other, Leader Tarondo. What if you and I could have a frank and logical discussion? The human race would be much more productive, stronger, and happier if we find some kind of compromise. We shouldn't work against one another." Ptolemy's smile was hopeful and naive. Manford did not smile back. "One does not compromise by cutting a thing in half. They are my core beliefs and principles." The scientist chuckled nervously. "Oh, I'm not asking for anything like that. Please hear me out. We all know that technology can be abused, but it isn't inherently evil. Some of our early experiments focused on growing sheets of polymer-based tissue to be grafted onto burn victims. Dr. Elchan's work. The Souk doctors already use it extensively. But we have gone far beyond that. My associate and I have brought you a gift created in our laboratories on Zenith." He gestured to the coffin case that bobbed on its suspensors like a rowboat on a lake. "You'll find it very beneficial." The quiet Tluloxa partner did not seem so optimistic. In fact, Manford could sense a deep-seated fear emanating from him, as if he were walking a tightrope across a deep chasm. Ptolemy, though, was like a puppy, smiling encouragement to his friend. After opening the case, the Tluloxa reached in and removed a flesh-colored object. An amputated leg.
Anari flinched, grabbed for her sword. Belchan blurted out, "No, it's no trick. Please, just look." Ptolemy sent his partner a questioning look, surprised at the reaction. No, Manfred realized upon closer inspection, it was a prosthetic leg sheathed in a very realistic, skin-like polymer. Ptolemy continued with unabashed pride in his voice. On Zenith, we have a separate independent laboratory dedicated to developing lifelike artificial replacement limbs that connect directly with biological nerve endings. In the past, many jihad veterans were forced to live as amputees. Earlier, before the organ farm troubles, he glanced over at Dr. Elchan, then back at Manfred. The Tluloxa labs provided tank-grown eyes or internal organs, but that work has been all but abandoned for almost a century. Now, he and I have created this new bionic system that, when properly attached and configured, can tap into your mind's impulses. The muscle analogs are responsive polymer fibers, and the nerve conductors are thin wires. He took the flopping false leg from his partner and held it up like a prop, poking at the flesh with his fingertips. Our gift to you, Leader Tarando, an olive branch to show you the real benefits of properly applied technology. With this, you shall walk again. Dr. Elchan and I can give you your legs back to let you see how science can help humanity and ease the hurt of so many who suffer. Manfred was not the least bit tempted by the offer. The Cymex used similar principles for their brains to operate machine forms. The human body is not a machine. Ptolemy looked baffled. But of course it is. A biological machine. The skeleton is a structural framework. Muscle fibers are like cables and pulleys. Blood vessels are fluid transport conduits. Nerve endings are like sensors. The heart is the engine, and the brain like a memory core. What you say is deeply offensive. The scientist seemed disappointed by Manfred's stony reaction, but he pressed ahead anyway with dogged determination. Please hear me out. If you will look at my friend and colleague, he turned to his Tluloxa partner, though the other man did not at all want the attention. Through a serious accident, Dr. Elchan lost the use of his left arm, and we have replaced it with one of these prosthetics. I doubt you even noticed it until now. The other man raised his arm, flexed his fingers, and used his real hand to tug a gray sleeve up to reveal the smooth plastic skin on his left arm. A shiver of revulsion ran down Manfred's back. Standing at the doorway of the office, Anari Idaho was also repulsed by the prosthetics. Still jabbering as if presenting a rosy progress report to a board meeting, Ptolemy removed the second leg from the coffin container. After we affix these to your body, you will be a whole man again. He didn't realize that he had stepped over a very important line. Fighting back his disgust, Manfred raised his chin and looked over at Anari. You know what to do, Swordmaster. Like a released spring, she drew her sword and shouldered the two scientists aside. With a surprised cry, Ptolemy dropped the artificial leg onto Manfred's desk, and Anari swung her blade like a woodsman chopping a log. Lubricants and nutrient fluids spurted, dousing the papers, but Manfred didn't flinch. Ptolemy and Elchan cried out in dismay. Anari struck three times before the first leg was mangled beyond repair, then she made quick work of the other. The mind of man is holy, she said. Sobbing, Dr. Elchan pulled his left arm tight against his chest, fearing the Swordmaster would hack the artificial limb off his body. Appalled, Ptolemy said in a hollow voice, as if he were the one who had been betrayed.
Why did you do that? Those legs were our gift to you.
Manfred almost pitied the man. He honestly didn't understand. There is a seductive quality to machine technology. It is a slippery slope. If I permit one thing, where do I draw the line? Manfred asked. I do not want to open that door. "But you use machines regularly, sir. Your logic is arbitrary." Unbelievable. The man was still trying to get through to him. In a way, he admired Ptolemy's dedication to his beliefs, even if they were wrong. "My faith is perfectly clear." Dr. Elchan was terrified and shuddering, but Ptolemy stuck to his principles. "Please, there must be something. If you won't allow us to give you replacement limbs, then we can create a simple suspensor platform for you to ride in." "No. A suspensor platform is still technology, a first step on the road to ruin, and I will not allow it. Your temptations won't work on me." Ptolemy pointed toward the naked sword Inari held. "Technology made that blade. Technology drives the starships that you use to travel from planet to planet. You accept it only when it meets your needs." Manfred shrugged, not willing to concede the point. "I am not perfect, and I make some sacrifices for the greater good. There are many thousands of worlds in the Imperium, and all of them need to hear my words. I can't simply shout across space. It's a necessary compromise. I have to use some forms of technology for the greater good." "That's a contradiction," Ptolemy said. "Faith sees through contradictions, while science cannot." He looked down at the mangled prosthetics. "But when it comes to my body, I draw the line. Sacred human flesh was made in God's image, and the only assistance I will accept in place of walking is from another human being. Countless volunteers are willing to carry me on a palanquin wherever I need to go. Inari here," he gestured to the swordmaster, "bears me on her shoulders when necessary." Ptolemy frowned, as if Manfred had spoken to him in a foreign language. "So, it is your preference to oppress a human being rather than use a simple wheelchair? Don't you see how demeaning it is to use a person as a beast of burden?" A flare of rage flushed Inari's face. "I consider it an honor." She raised her sword, stepping toward the two scientists, but Manfred stopped her from killing them. "There's no need for violence, my loyal companion. These misguided scientists came here to speak their point of view, and I agreed to hear them." She muttered under her breath, "I am not a slave. I serve you willingly." Manfred said to the two men, "I will not budge on the matter. I respect your dedication to your delusions, Dr. Ptolemy. If only you could see the light. Your mission here has been a complete waste of time, and this meeting is at an end. You may leave your equipment rubbish here. We'll see that it's disposed of properly." As the two scientists left in disgrace, Ptolemy looked back with obvious disappointment, devastated to see the mangled prosthetic legs. He looked so lost and confused. He simply couldn't comprehend a man whose convictions were different from his own. Manfred felt sorry for him, and for what would have to happen next. Be careful of the knowledge you seek, and the price you must pay for it. Axiom of the Sisterhood. When Joseph Venport returned from Denali, an unpleasant surprise awaited him at the Kolhar headquarters, one far more serious than the usual administrative problems he faced. His wife met him, accompanied by his security chief, Ekbir. Sioba said nothing at first, but he could read a wealth of concerns in her stolid expression. She let Ekbir deliver the information. "A spy, sir." Joseph went rigid as anger built within him, though he didn't dare show any reaction. The idea seemed utterly preposterous, but not unexpected. With its space fleet, planetary banking, and mercantile operations, Venport Holdings was much too influential and far-reaching not to attract malicious attention. "We neutralized him," Sioba said, "limited the release of information. I have ideas on how to deal with spies, but I thought I should check with you first." "Where did you find him?" Joseph asked. Ekbir steeled himself, met the director's gaze.
Out by the navigator fields, sir. The man posed as one of our technicians. He had the proper uniform, identification badge, access codes.
Find out how he got them. Ekbir gave a slow nod.
Already working on it, sir.
Joseph's thick eyebrows drew together. All Venhold maintenance technicians are carefully vetted and given specific psychological training. They're a close-knit team. How did he infiltrate them? Sioba nodded. That is exactly how he was caught. Though his credentials were impeccable, our people sensed something wrong. He was reported in less than an hour. Joseph's face turned warm as he pictured the plane covered with sealed tanks, each containing an embryonic navigator immersed in mutagenic concentrations of melange gas. He discovered what we're doing out there, I presume?
Yes, sir.
Ekbir had no way to deny it. Joseph had known the secret would leak out sooner or later. Norma Senvo was the first to experience the biological enhancements caused by long-term exposure to spice gas, but his great-grandmother's mind had been special in the first place. Only after a great deal of experimentation had another human candidate survived the change. Successes still comprised a relatively small percentage.
He hasn't revealed much to us yet, though we've only begun the interrogation process, Sioba said. I monitored it myself, and we've got Scalpel working on it.
Good. The specially trained torturers in the organization's Scalpel division were impeccable at inflicting long-term pain with no visible damage. He looked up at his wife, admired her pale skin, her porcelain-like beauty. Sioba's sorceress heritage was prominent on her features, but alas, she exhibited no telepathic powers. I wish you could just go into his mind and rip out the information. She stroked his arm with a brief electric touch.
Yes, we can wish. But in the meantime, we'll have to use other means.
Perhaps their two daughters would show greater mental strength once they grew older and completed their sisterhood training. We assume he was sent by one of the other commercial transport companies, anxious to learn about our navigators. Ekbir's voice faltered as he realized he was stating the obvious. Arjun Gates already had his company meddling with the spice operations on Arrakis. I put a stop to that, but I still don't believe he's learned his lesson. Joseph had taken great pleasure in watching the images Ishanti sent of the capture and destruction of poaching operations near Carthag, hurling the rival chief down into a Coriolis storm. None of the other space fleets had developed anything similar to navigators, and his competitors had only the vaguest idea why Venhold's ships never suffered a mishap, when their own blind flying resulted in high accident rates. Through careful analysis, Sioba had surmised that some of the other companies could be using computerized navigation devices, which were strictly forbidden. Venport had his own spies investigating the matter. Personally, Joseph had no qualms about using mechanical navigation devices, which he considered useful and reliable. He would have used them himself if he didn't have Norma's navigators, and the restrictions against them were just silly. Nonetheless, if he could prove that one of his rivals used outlawed computers, he wouldn't hesitate to report them, which would result in the confiscation and likely destruction of all ships in the competitor's fleet. It was, after all, only business. Let me see this spy, Joseph said.
We're holding him in an interrogation chamber, sir, pending your orders.
Joseph scratched his thick mustache, glanced at his wife. You know what my orders are going to be. Sioba led him out of the room, walking close beside him.
Don't take any precipitous action.
The security man guided them to the underground levels of the headquarters tower, where they met a gaunt man who kept his head bowed and displayed a funereal manner. Dr. Wantori had completed specialized training at the Souk School, although his degree was not a matter of public record. Over the course of their studies at the medical institution, certain adepts discovered a penchant for inflicting pain rather than relieving it.
Wontori was the best of the surreptitious scalpel interrogators and torturers that Joseph could find, another under-the-table compensation that he had arranged through Dr. Ori Joma.
"This way, sir," said Wontori in a grave voice. "We are beginning to make progress."
They stopped in front of an opaque plaz viewing window.
"Is he in there?" Joseph asked. "Why is everything dark?"
"There is nothing to see at the moment."
Wontori worked the screen, sliding through the spectrum. An image blurred, then focused as the sensors adjusted the range and mathematically shifted the display to visible light. A man hung at an angle in the middle of the chamber, arms and legs outstretched, with his head tilted toward the floor. He looked like a lost soul in an old story of limbo.
"What have you done to him?"
"He is unharmed, sir.
The chamber is devoid of light and sound. Suspensors negate the gravity. The temperature precisely matches his body temperature. In his own perceptions, he is nowhere."
Wontori looked up, blinked his large eyes as if he didn't like to reveal his techniques.
"Often, that's enough to break an interrogation subject, but this one hasn't revealed anything yet."
"I wouldn't have expected him to. Any man who could infiltrate my navigator field is no ordinary spy. He's either very dedicated or very well paid."
Joseph considered.
"I hope he's well paid, because a mercenary can be bought, whereas a man with political or religious convictions is harder to break."
Ekbir pointed out, "He is physically unharmed, except for some contusions and one broken finger, which he received while resisting capture."
"I healed it," Wontori said.
"Maybe you shouldn't have bothered," Joseph said.
The interrogator shook his head slightly.
"The pain of a broken bone or the ache of bruises decreases the effectiveness of sensory deprivation. It gives the subject something to hold on to, a focus. Now he has nothing, not even the pain. To him, it must seem as if 1,000 years have passed. And my procedure is just beginning."
Joseph said, "Let me speak to him."
Wontori looked alarmed.
"It'll be a setback to our disorientation process, sir."
"Let me speak to him." Joseph barely controlled his temper. The fact that someone would come here like a rapist in a nunnery offended him. For generations, the Venports had built their empire, funded research, constructed ships, acquired wealth and power. He found it deeply insulting that anyone would try to take what he had achieved.
Sioba nodded to the interrogator.
"Do as my husband says. It may yield some interesting results."
Wontori activated a set of controls, gestured toward an input speaker. When Joseph spoke, his words boomed into the lightless tank.
"My name is Joseph Venport."
After days of utter silence, without any sensation whatsoever, the captive spy must have thought he sounded like a deity.
"I can tell you're a professional at what you do, and I won't insult you by asking detailed questions. Dr. Wontori will take care of that for me. Will you at least do me the courtesy of